Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Howdy, partner.
Howdy. Well, we had an exciting day yesterday.
We did.
It was originally going to be taking some of the Reasons to be Cheerful listeners for Nando's, and it sort of spiralled from there, really, didn't it?
Yep. Spiralled is one way of putting it.
It was an upward spiral, not a downward spiral. Yes. We ended up doing a focus group.
Yes.
At Universal Music, who are friends of ours, lent us their boardroom.
Yeah.
With their enormous, shiny boardroom table.
Had nice views.
Beautiful views over London. And we gathered 8 Reasons to be Cheerful listeners.
Who were all lovely.
They were fantastic, weren't they? I was a bit scared because it being this record company, they told us a story about a famous recording artist who sat in on a focus group. Sometimes when they do these things, they have smoked glass like a mirror, you're hiding behind it. So this particular artist was listening to the general public give opinions on them, and they were so enraged that they burst into the focus group and borderline assaulted a member of the public.
I don't think you should be talking about in that way, though. We can't reveal that, can we?
No. Fortunately, I'm so afraid of confrontation that there was no danger of me doing that.
Generally, when politicians go to those focus groups with two-way glasses, it's generally a bad experience.
Have you had experience of that?
I haven't, although I did have sat in a lot of focus groups in my time, less about me, but I mean, I also used to get reports from polling and focus groups. But one Labour politician went along to one of these groups, and there was about a bunch of voters who were, I think they were trying to decide between Tories and Labour, and they said some pretty disobliging things about this individual, and he basically stormed out and said they're just a bunch of Tories.
So if you are if you're having polling on yourself reported back to you, how heavily redacted is it?
Very heavily redacted, right. In my case, I think.
But they were a lovely bunch of people.
They were.
We had a nice time. Some of the things we found out. I was keeping a toll of how many people had beards in the room. Out of the 8 people, 3 of them had beards.
Swing to the beardies.
Yeah. Just 1 pair of glasses, though. Interesting. Yeah, what else?
Swing away from myopics.
Most people are listening to the podcast whilst commuting either to work or to their studies. But people also listening to it whilst cooking.
Yeah.
And during bath time, we're a bath time treat for some of our listeners.
Interesting.
Yeah. You say interesting, but I can hear you stifling a yawn there.
Nope.
Do you want to know some of the other podcasts that they listen to that, as well as ours? No Such Thing as a Fish by the QI Elves. That seemed to be quite a popular one. As did My Dad Wrote a Porno. And Table Manners with Jessie Ware and her mum.
So the reason I was pausing was it made me think of these two people called Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, who are these two behavioral economists. And there's this brilliant book by Michael Lewis called The Undoing Project. And they have this thing called the law of small numbers. And the law of small numbers is defined as judgmental bias, which occurs when it is assumed that the characteristics of a sample population can be estimated from a small number of observations or data points. I'm sorry to piss on your chips.
Well, maybe you will give no credence to this final thing that I was going to tell you.
They were all lovely. They were all lovely. I'm just sort of...
But you're saying your opinions count for nothing.
No, I wasn't saying
that. Too small a sample size. You're saying it was a waste of hours and everybody else's time.
It's such an interesting subject, this law of small numbers, because there's this term in basketball called the hot hand, and it's sort of like people are on form, and they kind of show that the hot hand doesn't really exist. It's just a sort of random set of things that happen. Anyway, blah, blah.
Is your hand hot?
No.
You got something to tell us? Where's it been?
It's a metaphorical expression.
No, so the one bit of criticism that came out of the focus group that I thought I should put to you.
Yeah, we should definitely apply the law of small numbers to this. Yeah.
So one of our listeners, her husband, I got the impression, unlike her, is quite a staunch conservative.
Yes.
And it really gets his back up every time we refer to the conservatives.
Yes.
As Tories.
Tories, 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 Tories.
You're alienating her husband.
Okay, I promise you, husband of our very nice focus group participant, never again. Never again on the podcast.
What never again?
That I'll say Tories.
You've said it again!
No, I just got it out. I'm just getting it out of my system, okay?
Right.
It's gone now.
Okay.
I think it's a fair point, actually.
Okay. Well, there we go.
Yeah.
Despite the law of
it doesn't mean
numbers.
I won't say Tories outside the podcast, just to be clear.
Said it again.
Oh, sorry. It doesn't mean I won't say that word outside the podcast, but inside the podcast. Because I do often think about our Conservative listeners, and they are incredibly valued. And, you know, I don't come from that political persuasion, but we really value them like we value all our listeners, but I value you particularly. So I hear you.
Okay, good. That's addressed.
Good.
Has your hand cooled down? On to this week's podcast.
Oh, I'm really excited about this week's podcast because it is about a movement and an idea called divestment. And it's around climate change. And it's around this idea that pension funds, people who hold wealth, should be disinvesting or divesting from fossil fuel companies as a way to change behavior and hasten the very, very urgent transition away from fossil fuels towards renewable forms of energy and so on. And the Church of England has done a big push on this. Their pension fund, they've persuaded the mining company Glencore to change its behavior. We're going to be hearing from them. We're going to be hearing from a fantastic woman, Catherine Howarth, who runs something called Share Action, which has also been at the forefront of this campaign, and from a representative from the US, from an organization called 350.org, that I think were the originators of the whole divestment campaign, which is a huge global campaign now.
And if that wasn't exciting enough, we're going to be learning to beatbox.
Oh, we love Beardy Man.
We are joined by beatboxer, performing artist, sensation, Beardy Man.
Yeah.
What's your reason to be cheerful this week?
So my reason to be cheerful is that I sort of took the podcast on the road, not in the sense of a live show, which I didn't tell you about, although that would have obviously been entirely characteristic. But Christoph Igre, who we had on a great episode a few episodes ago about public space, my friend who's an architect, runs this thing called Studio Igre West, which is a big architect firm. He came up to Doncaster to talk to people on the council and others about public space, what advice he could offer. He did it just out of the goodness of his heart. And then we came back on the train together. And, well, first of all, we had two excited listeners who came up to us. They thought Christoph was you.
Oh, he's a very stylish man.
He is an extremely stylish Frenchman.
I'll
I mean,
take
like,
that.
way stylish more. Something.
I don't get what you're implying.
and we had these two lovely young people who came up to talk to us, one of whom works for BBC iPlayer. She is unusual, but she's a female software engineer. She's got this big team of 16 that she works in. I think she's the only woman in that team. Her boyfriend works on the BBC Sport app. We then had a long discussion about TARDIS tennis. Do you remember TARDIS tennis? It was this thing they released for like Wimbledon 1 year. You could play this like, you know, tennis game, blah, blah, blah. It was great. And they were lovely. It cheered me up. What's yours?
I've had a quiet week this week. I mean, a couple of little things. I made some very nice spiced potato cakes for brunch on Sunday. Does that count? I watched that documentary, Three Identical Strangers. Have you heard about it?
I have heard about it.
I mean, it takes quite a dark turn, but at the beginning, it's, you know, an extraordinary story about these three men of university age who discover that they're triplets and they were separated at birth and adopted through this particular adoption agency. But sort of before it takes a turn for the darker, there's a bit where they are living like kings in New York City, and they open their own restaurant called Triplets.
Wow.
And it just struck me as so odd that in our lifetime, people were queuing around the block to go to a restaurant just because of the novelty of it being run by Triplets.
It still exists.
No, it closed down in the year 2000. But you can still buy the mugs on eBay. It's my birthday soon.
When is your birthday?
20th of April.
Shit. Better not miss it.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
We're joined now by Adam Matthews, who's Director of Ethics and Engagement for the Church of England Pensions Board, and he joins us on the phone from Dublin. Adam, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Just tell us a little bit about how the Church of England has come to be involved in this whole question of shareholder engagement on climate change.
Well, we're a shareholder in many companies. The Church of England Pensions Board is a £2.5 billion pension fund for the clergy, retired clergy, and also for people that work for the church. And so We obviously have a responsibility to provide them with a pension, and as a result, we're invested in many companies. But we take our sort of responsibilities very seriously, that we don't just invest in them for the return. We actually want to ensure that the companies we're invested in are actually contributing positively to wider society. And obviously, issues like climate change are extremely important to us. So we engage, we use our position as a shareholder. We have various rights as a shareholder, and we exercise those rights. And that can be done in a number of ways, from filing shareholder resolutions, from intervening at company AGMs, and equally just from the dialogue that we have with the company boards. So we use a variety of measures, and we sort of work with other investors as well to form sort of coalitions to maximise the impacts that we're trying to have.
And I think I'm right in saying that the Church of England Synod passed a resolution around the Paris Climate Change Agreement and the desire to invest in companies that were acting consistently with that. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, so last year, the Synod, the Church Parliament, basically reviewed our work on climate change and in particular how we're engaging. And it very much sort of backed the approach that we're taking, which is that we are engaging. But we're also very clear with companies that we have an expectation that they need to align their businesses to the Paris Agreement. And so they reinforce that commitment. And companies that are not aligning with the Paris Agreement by 2020, and in particular, if they haven't aligned on a trajectory to below 2 degrees by 2023, there will be candidates for us to disinvest from. So obviously, that still gives us a bit of time to conduct our engagement, but it's an engagement with a focus. And we've also created a tool, which sort of is an independent academic tool at the London School of Economics called the Transition Pathway Initiative, which is going to be the base upon which we assess whether companies are making the progress we need them to or not. And that was very much the sort of position Synod took, that they welcomed the creation of the Transition Pathway Initiative, which is now backed by investors with $14 trillion in assets that they manage, and we'll be using that sort of independent source to determine if companies are moving in the right direction.
And tell us a little bit about, in practice, what the effects of your investor voice has been. I know it starts with Shell, and then recently the church was involved in a wider campaign around Glencore.
For the first time, you've got a level of coordination between investors that's never happened before. There's an enormous sort of collective focus that we need to work together across the sort of investment industry. And so you've got collaborations going between all the global investor networks. And you've got sort of like enormous numbers, like $34 trillion now are collaborating in global engagement with companies. And that in itself is having an enormous impact in terms of focusing the major emitting companies on the sort of demands of their investor base. I led the negotiations with the Dutch counterparts, with Shell, and just before the UN climate conference in Poland last year, we had the first agreement with an oil and gas company and their long-term shareholders that basically committed them to aligning their business towards Paris, agreeing with their investors that they're going to seek to reduce the carbon intensity of their impact. They've set targets covering all of those emissions. They're also linking it to their pay of their senior executives. And at the same time, they are being absolutely transparent in terms of how they're actually going to measure their performance and be able to communicate that with shareholders. And lastly, and probably hugely significantly, they're also committed to review all their lobbying and funding of trade associations and lobby bodies, which are having a very disproportionate impact on the sort of whole global climate debate. So my sense is that we're at an absolute key moment where you've got investors collaborating globally. You've got independent tools that investors have created in academic institutions, such as the Transition Pathway Initiative. And now you're getting the first companies starting to make very credible, serious commitments that is changing their business models. Is it enough? I don't yet know, but it's definitely starting to see some significant movement.
That was my next question, actually. You anticipated it, which is whether it's enough. I mean, in other words, some of our listeners will think, yeah, but this is Shell. They're continuing to want to produce oil and gas for decades ahead. You know, the IPCC said we've got 10 years to really, you know, turn these things round. How would you respond to that?
Well, I mean, I think that's an absolutely legitimate question, and I think we're all trying to understand exactly what is going to be enough. I think increasingly time is ever against us, but the kind of commitment that Shell's come out with is a credible one, in the sense that they are moving from oil to gas. Gas does have a role in the transition over the coming decades, but equally they're looking at how they can expand their activities, and they are investing in low carbon battery technologies or in other renewables. And so they're looking in effect to sort of become an energy producer of green energy as well as of gas. And that's a sort of credible path that you can see an oil and gas company taking. Now, the proof is going to be very much in the delivery of this. And we've built in key points in the coming years to review the ambition and how this sits with the objectives of the climate process in the UN. But at the same time, you're going to see other approaches emerge as well from other companies, where in effect, they're probably just going to have to stop looking to produce more oil. And I think that you'll see these approaches emerge in the coming sort of months and years, as really they all grapple with the pressure that they're now under from their investor community. And we're obviously all looking and asking, is it enough? And I think we've got some key points at which we'll be taking a judgment on that.
And you've also been involved in the wider push on Glencore, Australia's largest miner in terms of the amount of coal it produces. And they've recently made an agreement about limiting their production. One Australian coalition minister accused, quote, latte sipping greens. That's you, I think. I'm not accusing you of being a latte sipping green or complimenting you with that. But I think they're talking about organisations like the Church of England Pension Fund that were part of this Climate Action 100 Plus. Is that an important milestone, the Glencore decision?
Yeah, no, I mean, look, you've got one of the largest coal producers in the world for the first time making a commitment that they don't see increased coal production as the sort of the future path for their coal business. Now, that in and of itself is a hugely significant message, and it's obviously generated the reaction it has amongst some of those that are very pro-coal. And you have an enormously strong pro-coal lobby in parts of Australia that's had a very significant influence upon the political system there. Glencore have been the first coal company to make that commitment. There's a question in terms of how this gets delivered, and obviously we are keen to sort of follow through on the agreement that they've reached. We are talking with other mining companies. I also am involved in discussions with Anglo American, which is obviously the UK, one of the sort of largest coal producers that's listed in the UK, and we're talking about basically when they see their coal production being reduced. And I think all of these companies are under that kind of pressure. We're getting these commitments, we're putting these into a framework to assess if they're good enough, and then we're basically monitoring the companies with a view to putting further pressure if they aren't being delivered in a time frame that's consistent with what we need to achieve globally. So it was significant, and I think it's the beginning of a very significant shift away from coal by some of the major players.
One last question. We have a thing on the podcast called the Jeffocracy, where I, Jeff, am appointed supreme ruler, but I'm very hands-off. I'm trying to think what position we might give you in the administration, because I'd always intended church and state to be quite separate. But if we made you maybe Minister for Investments or Pensions, what is the first thing that government could be doing better in this area?
Investors and pension funds have enormous power, and often it's an unrealised power, and a power that I don't think, if they do know they've got it, many have used. And I think what you're seeing is a giant that is awakening in the investment sector that is going to drive change alongside what governments need to do. Governments can help by enabling investors through better regulation, requirements on companies to disclose strategies in the way that Shell have. They've played a very important role, and the governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, has played an extremely important role in sort of saying that there's a whole heap of public disclosure companies have got to make. It didn't go far enough in terms of requiring companies to set targets, but it did set a trend here that I think investors have been enabled to sort of push in the way that we are beginning to. So my sense is that we actually have an enormous amount of power. We need, obviously, government regulation and laws to align to the Paris Agreement, because where they currently are is just around the 3 degrees mark. So there does need to be more regulation, and that ultimately does drive a lot of performance in key sectors such as the car industry, electric utilities. But equally, I'm quite conscious that we do have the power as it stands. We just need to use it, mobilise it.
Adam Matthews, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So we're very pleased to speak now to Yossi Caden, who is Global Senior Divestment Campaigner at 350.org. Yossi, thank you so much for joining us. I wondered if, first of all, you could talk to us a little bit about 350.org and the history of divestment campaigning.
The divestment campaign started in 2012, and it was kicked by Bill McKibben, who went through a big sort of, I would say, bus tour in the U.S. 300 different educational institutions. He appeared and gave speeches, and there was a big crowd of students that were eager to hear him to start the divestment campaign, which, you know, since then become bigger and bigger until today, which is, you know, become a very significant campaign, I think. One of the most successful climate change campaign that happened in the last decade or so.
And can you talk us a little bit about the work of those campaigns and what has been achieved?
Just going back to the reasons of these campaigns, I mean, like, it all started with a group of people, economists, who look at the shares of fossil fuel companies, and, you know, fossil fuel companies, as part of their disclosure to their shareholders, have to say how much reserve, proven reserve of fossil fuels they have. So these economists say, well, let's check how much they declare on their reserves and try to bring that all together. And they found a very interesting thing, that the amount of proven reserve that those fossil fuel companies are declaring, you know, in the stock exchange and to their shareholders, it's bigger 5 times than we allow to burn if we want to keep the climate under 2 degrees, which is, you know, cause a few issues. One is that, you know, some of this money and shareholders that putting this money are basically putting their money on something that may not be able to happen. So if we want to keep the climate. And the second, which is obviously, if you are putting your money into that, you're doing something that it's immoral, because it's definitely sort of you give hand to extract those reserves that shouldn't be extracted. So that was the rationale. And as I said, I mean, like, at the beginning, it was mostly universities. So students in different universities organized themselves and asked the university, as, you know, institution who basically teach the science and say that the science saying that we can't really burn this amount of fossil fuels, and demand their universities to withdraw their investments that they have, endowment mostly, from fossil fuels. It's important to understand that the divestment campaign, like any other divestment campaign, didn't start because we thought that we can bankrupt the fossil fuel industry. That wasn't the case. You know, even if it's true, we thought at the beginning, I mean, like, the thinking was that that will take too much time, and we don't have that time, I mean, like, to bankrupt. And especially when you talk about, you know, oil company, you're talking about companies that have lots of liquidations and assets on their own. So that's probably not going to happen very fast. So the idea was to use the divestment as a political tool to delegitimize the fossil fuel industry and to create sort of this political space for politicians to come on board and regulate the industry to what it should be.
Yossi, tell us, what is the balance or the interaction of divestment and shareholder activism demanding change? Are these two sides of the same coin in your view, or are they opponents?
I wouldn't say that they're opponents. I mean, like, let's say that if you look at the history, and let's talk about fossil fuel companies, because shareholders activism had its own space, and many times it's working, you know, it's, you know, one of the best strategies that can work, especially if you have a company that basically you said, we want you to change your policy. So, for example, let's say forest company, you say that we don't want you to source any more old growth. We want you to sort of go to other and source from other places. then shareholders' resolutions can be very effective because you can intervene, you can make your demands, and if you have enough shareholders that come on board, your demand can be very strong. The problem when it comes to fossil fuel companies, it's a bit different because, you know, essentially what we ask them is to close their businesses in a couple of years. So it's not about, you know, change your practices or do this thing or another. We say basically, I mean, like we ask you for, you know, a phase out plan. It's a suicide in terms of their stock markets. They will, you know, go to zero and even negative in no time. It was a path that few organizations like the Church of England, for example, choose to go when they put shareholder resolutions. I mean, like, and they got something. I mean, like, you know, they got Exxon to say, we are going to disclose our carbon emissions, et cetera, et cetera. But from that point to say, we are actually phasing out our oil and, you know, not going to look for another reserves and et cetera, that's still really far. And I doubt if that's sort of compatible with the amount of time that we have to avert any climate disaster.
So when you hear about organizations like Climate Action 100 Plus, which controls these tens of trillions of dollars around the world, they are, as I understand it, some combination of shareholder activism with the threat of divestment.
Yeah.
And you think there's a place for that, yes?
Yeah, that's the other side. I mean, like, I think when you come to a company and say, you know, we want you to produce a plan that it's compatible with the Paris Agreement and the 2 degrees, and if you're not going to do that by the end of 2020 or so, we are actually going to divest, that's a complete legitimate. You know, if you put a plan that basically said what actually you need to do in order to comply with the Paris Agreement, this is something that will cause, you know, each one of these corporation fossil fuel companies to, as I said, I mean, like basically decide on a phase out in this sort of time frame, this or never. So shareholder resolutions that actually put that limit and say we will divest is a good solution. I mean, like when they put that time target in place.
And where does your campaign go next, Jossi? I think you've implied that this began in a few colleges in America and has become a global movement. Where do you see it going in the urgent months and years ahead?
Looking at the political sphere, and I wouldn't say losing hope, but seeing that they're moving way too slow than what we need. I mean, like, we are in a definitely sort of an urgent situation. And one of the thinking is that, you know, using the work and the expertise that we have on divestment, we can ramp up our campaign to the next level and talk about financing, direct financing. So, I mean, like, we know the fossil fuel industry needs loans, needs insurance, needs a lot of things to operate. And the idea is to sort of to take the same model that we use in the divestment or a similar model. So means like to do it decentralized and use the power of the grassroots and go after those banks or institutions that actually fueling the fossil fuel industry and demand them to just, you know, do that. Obviously, I mean, like, that's not new. I mean, like, there are a few organizations that are already doing that work in different places. I think the uniqueness is about 350 will be that we will do that through the grassroots and through the network that we have, not sort of through lobbying and direct conversation with those institutions.
Okay, Jossi Caden, very inspiring to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'm delighted to say that we are now joined in our studio by Catherine Howarth, who runs an organization called Share Action. And Catherine and I have known each other a long time. She was at a fantastic organization called West London Citizens, which became Citizens UK when we first met. And she runs Share Action. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Tell us a bit about Share Action and what you do.
Share Action is building people power in the investment industry, particularly, you know, millions and millions and millions of people are pension savers now, and that gives them, you know, in a way, quite a bit of power, because what happens with their pension contributions when they disappear out of a paycheck once a month is it goes to buy, you know, the biggest companies in the world, shares in the biggest companies in the world. And we're all interested in what the biggest companies in the world get up to. So that's the sort of space that we're working in, trying to democratize the pension system. I hate that word, whoops. But it's trying to make sure that the decisions made in that system are really useful for everyday working people. We do a lot on climate change. I know we're going to talk about that, but it's not the only issue. You know, that companies as employers, companies in the way they operate all over the world, make a difference to us. And we just feel the whole system needs to be more accountable.
And the truth is, as we've discussed a number of times, you know, most people are very passive when it comes to their pension in terms of where it's invested.
They are, but, you know, they're waking up. And
you're waking them up.
Yeah.
You're the wake-up call.
Yeah, I'm this person that comes at 7 a.m. in the morning and shakes everyone exactly. on the shoulder.
Do people have control and agency over their own pensions then?
Well, very little. The system is totally designed to make sure that you, first of all, don't know what happened to the money, and that if you do know and you do care, you're kept well away from any of the important decisions. But that is changing little by little. So, you know, some of the things I'm really proud of that we've won are some changes that require pension funds to tell you where they put the money and how they voted at the important AGMs of the companies in the portfolio. So we're beginning to win some more rights to information and influence, but it's not a system designed to empower the ordinary person. There's a long way to go.
And we're talking on the podcast about divestment and the particular issue of climate change. Tell us a little bit about ShareAction's role in this whole thing.
Sure. Well, we, as you can sort of tell from our name, ShareAction, the big thing we're into is shareholder activism. So we buy shares in companies and then we pop up at their annual general meetings.
To cause trouble.
That's one way of putting it, to, you know, ask some constructive questions of the board. And the amazing thing about it over the years, we've been doing this a long time, is that little by little we've secured as allies in that process some very, very big and powerful investors. And
including the Church of England, who we just heard from.
Church of England and Nest, which is the big pension provider set up by the government for pensions automatic enrolment. They're actually an amazing scheme, really engaged with what's going on in the companies in the Nest portfolio. And so we've slowly built some great relationships with big investors. And when we make the case to companies for change, we've got some quite big friends.
And what's the leverage that you have? Is it that you make them feel uncomfortable at these AGMs by asking difficult questions? Or is it that you say, we're going to take the money out of this company and put it elsewhere?
Well, the take the money away threat is a real and interesting one. And obviously the divestment movement is built on it. But it's not the only threat. So the great thing about being a shareholder is you've got some voting powers. You can decide who's on the board of the company. And that's why it's important to have really big shareholders working with you, because they have a lot of votes.
You're the sort of foot in the door. You're not buying billions of pounds worth of shares. You get a share or two to get your foot in the door and persuade the big investors to then support your resolutions, basically.
That's right. So we are, I think, I'm proud of being probably the best example of of how much power you can wield with a single share. It's not so much a threat. It's also about building the so-called business case for change. So on climate change, great example, it's genuinely quite risky to just proceed with business as usual. We point that out. Some of the, you know, again, campaigns I'm really proud of, the work we've been doing in the banking sector, where even though banking is a sort of, in a way, it's a low carbon industry because it's just a few sort of glassy tower blocks here and there in business districts, or, you know, branches on high streets. But actually, the lending decisions of the banking sector probably make it one of the most important industries to engage with if you're interested in climate change. Because every time they finance a coal mine, or every time they decide instead to finance some wind turbines in the North Sea or something, that is a really material difference to our climate outcomes. So we've really been pushing the banks and bringing other big shareholders with us. And we make the case that it's just unwise financially to be lending to coal. And we've been quite successful in that, because it is unwise.
And just to explain the unwise part of it, there's this sort of concept, isn't there, of stranded assets. So, you know, basically, if if governments change their practices on climate change, it won't be possible, whatever you think of the ethics of it, won't be possible to use these so-called assets like coal and so on, and therefore you'll have lent money or you'll be invested in things and you'll lose your money, basically.
Bad investment. That's
the sort of simple way of putting it. It's a bad investment.
Exactly. Yeah.
And just on climate, tell us about some of the activism you've been doing and some of the change that you've seen. I mean, how much change are we seeing from companies, do you think?
There's the activism that's targeting companies that are energy users, and then there's the activism targeting companies like Glencore, Shell,
fossil
BP,
fuel companies.
That are the energy providers.
Yeah. And what about that? What progress is being made on those, would you say?
Well, you know, that is... It's work in progress.
A tougher nut to crack.
It's a tough nut.
There is this
Church
of England decision around Glencore, which we've heard
absolutely.
About.
Absolutely. We've been very closely involved in the work behind the scenes on that. So very proud of that. I first filed a shareholder resolution at BP and Shell back in 2010. So we're 9 years on and they're slowly swinging around, but it is slow progress. And actually, the pace of change in the fossil fuel industry is absolutely not commensurate with the climate challenge right now. So we need much more pressure. And by the way, the source of that pressure needs to be ordinary people, you know, like those that listen to this wonderful podcast that have a pension and think, yes, you know what? I don't want my pension invested in the companies that are still not with it.
So what can people do then? If you listen to this and you've got a pension and you want to feel like you can wield some kind of pension power.
Yeah, well, what you should absolutely do is make sure and write to your pension fund to make sure that they're in something called the Climate Action 100 Plus Investor Group, which is the biggest coalition of investors around the world acting on
climate
change.
And that's tens of trillions of pounds, yes?
It is.
Dollars, rather.
Yeah. Well, pounds and dollars. And you should make sure that the people that make decisions on your pension fund board have had some training on climate change. You'd be amazed how few of the pension trustees and the board members have actually really learnt about the science. And once they do, that really makes a difference. If you really fancy getting involved in this, then get in touch with Share Action because we train people to go to these company AGMs and ask the questions.
Oh, great.
We had the most brilliant time at BP's AGM last year.
Not everyone says that about BP's AGM.
Oh, my goodness. It was really, they always get a lot of activists go to the AGM and they've always held it in London. I think they thought they'd shake off the activists by moving the AGM to Birmingham and not a bit of it. We had a brilliant training up in Birmingham and we were,
We
were virtually half the room. We had question after question putting the board, really well-designed question. We prepare people and they're really well-researched questions. You know, we're not joking about here. It's really
Is it
serious.
Temporary embarrassment for the board or is it more than that?
Well, I mean, the answers they give are very telling and they're public. You know, they're a lot of journalists are also in the room. And, what the board say at the AGM is on the record. It's a very important public statement.
And if people want to know what they should... Because, you know, people might be thinking, well, okay, I like the idea, but what do I actually say in my letter to the pension fund and da-da-da-da-da? That's all that information on your website?
Come to the Share Action website or just give us a call. We would like to be inundated.
Is this route through the pension funds and so on, does divestment / shareholder activism work?
Yes. I think... It's quite amazing what's going on. By the way, it's not the only thing. We also need, of course, we need bold action from governments. But ultimately, most of the world's emissions are tied up with the fossil fuel industry. By the way, also the agricultural sector is a whopping producer of greenhouse gas emissions. These are industries where people have commercial interests and operations, and it's hugely important and necessary that the powerful financiers and investors in those companies are not only pushing for change, but being held to account about how the kind of dialogue they have with the companies on this.
We need more pension funds and others signing up.
Well, we just need to get bigger. I mean, by the way, it's like more reasons to be cheerful. The whole thing has just been taking off in such a dynamic way. Like, you know, 10 years ago, responsible investment was like a bit of a joke in the investment industry. It is not a joke anymore. You know, the biggest fund manager in the world is BlackRock. And they are marketing like crazy how good they are on this. By the way, they're not perfect, but the minute they're saying how important it all is, we kind of got them in a useful place. And then, you know, a lot of the work that we do at Share Action is trying to really get under the skin of what's really going on, because there is a lot of greenwashing in the investment industry now, and that needs to be exposed. So that's part of what's needed. But we also need stronger regulations and laws. We're seeing that in the UK. Brilliant. Some really important developments from whether it's, you know, the Bank of England Governor Mark Carney, but also the Financial Conduct Authority, the Pensions Minister. It's sort of all happening, and then it's very much happening at EU level. In fact, Europe is really leading the world on this agenda. I mean, we lead the world on loads of things, don't we? But it is a global industry, finance, and we're doing some things in Europe which I think are having a big ripple effect in a very positive way.
We have a thing on the podcast called The Jeffocracy, where I am installed as a benign but very hands-off supreme leader. If I was to make you Minister for Pensions, but say, off you go, you have autonomy, what is the first thing you do on day one?
I think what we need is to really open up the space so people are not in sort of this enforced ignorance around what happens to their pension funds. That's just not fair. So I would like to see a law that requires pension funds to ask you your views about climate change and sustainability risks, so that that can be built into the way that they invest on your behalf. So I think that's totally doable, absolutely necessary. By the way, one of the byproducts of that is that people might actually think, do you know what, I actually do need to maybe buy one less coffee at Costa and put a bit more money in my pension, because it's, you know, that's the other side of pensions is saving enough for our old age. But along the way, we do not want to be invested in things that are destroying the potential for a serene and happy retirement. And so it's joining the dots and making people able to have a voice in the system.
Catherine Howe, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
So what did you think?
I think it's exciting. It's exciting to think that we have some degree of influence over these big corporations. I quite like the idea of shareholder action, going to an AGM, making people squirm, asking some difficult questions.
I can see you at an AGM. I mean, I think what is fascinating is that this is a movement, the divestment movement, that started, you know, on a few campuses in the United States, and now it is a multi-trillion dollar campaign, a version of shareholder engagement and divestment. You've got the Church of England involved, you've got the Norwegian state sovereign wealth company involved. So there is, I mean, there's definitely a reason to be cheerful.
Definitely. And I would definitely like to see somebody using this kind of power with my pension,
which
if I had a pension.
Which you don't have, which is another subject. I mean, I don't want to be a downer.
Oh, no.
So Bill McKibben, who founded 350.org, and you know what? Do you know why it's called 350.org?
I don't.
So 350 was the attempt to sort of stop dangerous climate change by stabilizing the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at 350 parts per million, which is why it's called 350.org. It's currently somewhere around 410 parts per million. Okay, but that's not the bad part, actually. I mean, that is a bad part, but it's, I mean, he wrote this piece saying winning slowly is the same as losing. And I think the thing I take out of this, and I think this is where Yossi is right, is what you've got to avoid in this, and I'm not saying it's subject to this, is sort of greenwash. You know, oil companies saying, oh, yes, you know, we're going to do this, heroic assumptions, because they've got these, sometimes they have these heroic assumptions that says carbon dioxide emissions carry on going up for like 20 years, and then they sort of fall magically, and it's all right. We don't have that time.
Email us, reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter @cheerfulpodcast, or search for our Facebook page, Reasons to be Cheerful Podcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And here to pitch some ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful, we are joined by Beardy Man. Hello.
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 How are you doing? Well, now, for people who aren't familiar with your oeuvre, and I think Ed is included in this, I am right in sort of thinking that most of what you do is musical in nature.
Yeah, I'm primarily a musical man, and I do musical things, often with my face, kind of beatboxy, singy things. Sometimes I use electronics, but I haven't got any electronics, so I could demonstrate very briefly by going...
Yeah!
Wow, that was go on, Ed. Your turn.
That hit it.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Do you want to do it again?
Do you want to do it again? Sorry, I'm full of.
I'm honestly making myself so cheerful. That is absolutely brilliant. We definitely want to record this.
That's all then. But everyone just needs to beatbox, and you'll be super cheerful.
Honestly, I'm like super cheerful. That is definitely
it's so good.
Go on, yeah, you have a go.
I like the skills.
What's the sort of equivalent of, you know, plink plank plonk on the piano?
Well, you can say boots and cats with none of the vowels, and then you're sort of you've done it. And that's it. Give it a go. Boots and cats.
Boots and cats.
You sound quite Germanic.
No vowels. Still got some vowels in there. Just work on eliminating those vowels and you're there. Okay, let's try something simpler. That's good. Now. Yes, I just taught Ed Miliband to beatbox. Bang.
Wow, that was a moment.
That's it.
That was a moment.
A whole new career lies ahead of you now.
Hi, it's brilliant. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, nice to be here. Cheers, bye.
Oh, that is brilliant.
Yeah.
Let's just do it again. Look, that the one I did. What? How'd you do it?
Oh, wow, that's
there
a
we
duo.
Go.
That's,
yeah.
sick. That's sick.
We should take this on the road.
We definitely should.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've got it, guys.
How did you get into it?
We discourage most children from doing extra vocal sounds, but I wouldn't listen to reason, and I just carried on going. For me, when I was a kid, I was watching Police Academy and things like that, and realizing that you could do mouth noises. And
so
that
can you do all like the helicopter and the machine gun?
I'm going to try. Machine gun? Everyone's got a different...
Wow.
Can you do a machine gun?
No.
Wow. There you go.
This is a revelation to you, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I'm sort of incredulous. I didn't even know this. I sort of knew, I mean, obviously heard the term, but I you know, I didn't sort of engage with it.
If you'd have known it was there, you could have been a
I can't say, the thing I love the most is your helicopter. Can you do the helicopter again? I mean, that is...
I can also do a World War One biplane, which is, again, completely useless skill. It's nice, but it's pointless. Why? Imagine if you'd have done that at PMQs. That would have stopped them dead in their tracks. They'd be like, what?
Totally.
Do that again.
True. Or the helicopter.
You know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. They'd have scattered.
Or the machine gun. I mean any of them.
Yeah, or if after you've made a really banging point, yeah. You can be like, like that. And then you win the debate. As a rebuttal, the Right Honourable Ed Miliband, you stand up and then just start barking. And what are they going to say to that? You can't come back.
There wouldn't be an answer.
No. Then you'd win. Again. Just winning. Winning solutions.
Yeah, I'm not sure about again, actually. But we'll gloss over that.
All right, you've brought along some ideas.
I've brought along ideas.
Well, some noises.
What's the first one?
Well, so I've got two ideas, really. The first, I think, is eminently achievable. So both ideas are to do with switching, because I think these are times of change. We need to adapt to that, and we need to lead the change instead of be changed by this tempestuous world. So the first one is about switching the Earth off and on again, and this is eminently achievable. We have the technology to do it.
Is this like a reset button?
The reset button for the Earth. So
it tends to work on most electronic equipment.
It does, and there's so much electronics on the Earth, why not just do it to the whole planet? Basically, you take a rocket, which we know we can do, land it on an asteroid, which we know we can do, give it a little bit of a boost, maybe attach a solar sail to it, so it's got just the right trajectory, and then you've got this large, maybe 20 kilometre wide, iron-rich object careening towards the Earth. It'll smash into it, it'll extinguish most surface life, but you won't get that pesky radioactive fallout of a thermonuclear apocalypse, which would be deleterious to the recovery period after the catastrophe. And the rate we're going...
So we're destroying
all life on the planet, but we're going to anyway. So my point is that we're going
get
to
get it over
anyway.
And done with.
Get it over and done with.
In a much cleaner way.
It's less cruel if you just rip that plaster off and just wipe the slate clean, because you'll still there'll still be life. They'll still have microbes and extremophiles living in the Earth's crust. So there'll still be.
Isn't there a bit of a flaw in this plan, which is that when you restart, even a sort of hard reset on your iPhone or whatever, you can sort of store the settings in the iCloud.
Mm.
Whereas what's the sort of equivalent of the iCloud in this?
Well, there isn't one. Life
I'm worried
will
about
continue.
The, sort of, the
It'll be different. Life will be different. You'll have brand new, complex life evolving.
Evolution will go off in a different direction.
Yeah, it's not for us to decide. You know, we keep trying to control the world. We need to stop global warming. Yeah, maybe. Just, you know, press the reset button and start again. You won't have any problems anymore. You know, you won't have to worry about, well, what do we do after it? You won't
it feels
really
a bit gloomy to me.
What about all the nice things we've made, like cardigans and Stockport? I mean, all those things will be gone, right?
They will be, but there'll be no one there to miss them, which I think is really uplifting. You know, there'll just be the sweet release of death. And
that's dark.
It's fairly dark, but I think it's preferable to no deal Brexit.
I hope you don't tell that to your kids.
No, they don't listen to this podcast, so it's fine.
No.
But that we can do, but we shouldn't.
So you don't think we should hard reset the Earth by smashing an asteroid into it?
I mean, we could. We could do. There's a lot of things we could do. It's an option. I don't think it's necessarily the best one, but we could do it.
And we're a hard audience, but I think it's sort of a little bit extreme for me.
Yeah. I mean, we're looking for things to be cheerful about, and basically you're asking us to be cheerful about, well,
extinction.
Extinction, but different forms of life might evolve. Just think they might have 3 ears.
That's new and exciting. I think that's really cool. You never know what there'll be. Giant caterpillars.
I think we saved that for the sort of third term of the Jeffocracy, don't you think?
Yeah.
I think you need to sort of really kind of get your feet under the table and sort of win the trust of the electorate before embarking on that, don't you think?
Yeah, I don't think I think it's, and it's not a vote winner.
No, I sort of feel it's your sort of poll tax equivalent. You know?
Wait till you get your foot in the door.
Yeah.
And then just landed on him.
Yeah, okay, I think
third
so.
Term,
yeah.
All right, what else you got then?
So the second one is not so achievable, but it's definitely something we should do.
Well, I hope it's slightly less sort of extinction oriented.
It's way better. It's really dull, but it could solve all the world's problems and doesn't need to have anyone be wiped out by an asteroid.
Good.
So basically we should switch to a party list system. And I know that we tried electoral reform and it didn't work, but that's only because people campaigned against it. But if we did switch to a party list system instead of first past the post and make every government department a cross-party entity with membership proportionally reflective of the vote, perhaps even having a voting system whereby party lists are more thorough, wherein you vote for a party to represent each government department for your geographical area, you might find that the sort of partisan squabbling which engulfs every single part of government and every single part of life.
Explain the last bit again.
I said this is really dull.
What's the thing about the geographical area?
Well, so with the party list system, you have larger constituencies.
Right. So it's like the region of Yorkshire, right?
Something like that, yeah. And with the party list system, you list, instead of the individual that you want, you list the party that you want. And then you get government departments filled up in the order that the party dictates. So basically you're voting for a party instead of an individual. It's an alternative voting
system. So you're
system.
Voting for a sort of coalition.
You would end up with lots of cross-party squabbling within government departments.
You have one vote.
You would have one vote, yes. But it means, I mean, basically what I'd like to do is get rid of all political parties because I think they're a problem. But you can't really do that. Because you can't stop people wanting to form them, and maybe you shouldn't want people to not form political parties. Maybe you need to design democratic systems around this natural predisposition to coagulate.
We are unusual in not having coalitions, and part of that, I think, is the first past the post system.
Mm. But do you think the first past the post is good?
It's good for the Labour Party.
Is it?
Yeah, I mean, aren't both main parties interested in preserving it because you end up with one or the other?
But I quite like the continental systems where you come second and then become the prime minister.
There was a sketch from Alvides Aimpet that got promoted by both sides of the debate when it was the I think it was the alternative vote system that was there was a referendum about. And this sketch that was cited by both sides as a reason that you both should and shouldn't have voting reform was this sketch where they're trying to figure out what colour they should paint their room, and they decide to go with the alternative vote system, and it ends up being that none of them get what they want, but they all get their second choice. And you could argue that that's a good thing or a bad thing. You could say that democracy is the sort of best of all the worst solutions, or you could say that you don't like that that's what it is.
Here's what I like, the breadth of your ideas. I did not think
very dull.
That was where you were going to go after
really
the asteroid
dull.
Idea.
It's quite good macro and micro.
Yeah. and just to be clear, you're not presenting us with an either-or option.
Well, it is slightly either-or.
Right.
Either mass extinction or...
or this party list.
It's covering all the bases.
Mm.
I mean, it's such a divisive world at the moment. And now political party membership has become almost religious in its fervour. And the only way to dismantle that or to make people climb down off these kind of opinion mountains is probably to adapt our democratic systems in some way. Do you not think that urgent reform is needed? Otherwise, there'll be a bloody revolution.
I need a diagram,
really boring,
to be honest.
It's really boring. Yeah, I've been thinking way too much about it.
What about the German additional member system, whereby you have people elected directly in constituencies? I think that's 50%. And then you have the sort of top up to make it proportional to the overall vote.
That sounds cool. I just think a good, robust debate about voting systems is what we need. Because people are getting so disenchanted. They want to feel that...
And then we could have a referendum, and they obviously solve everything, don't they? I mean, they are absolutely the panacea for problems. I think we've shown that.
But that was a problem of democratic design. There was a yes-no answer, and Remain was a very simple, clear thing. But then Leave wasn't actually an option. They should have had five different options on there, or had a 60% threshold like they do in many referenda. So it's not that democracy's broken, it's just that it needs little tweaks, little fixing.
Mm.
Yeah, it was very dull. It was
It was good. It's serious, weighty.
As was the. I mean, there's nothing more serious, nothing more grave, in fact, than the asteroid suggestion.
I've got one other question though.
Yep.
Can you give us another noise?
if people want to enjoy your work, can they come and see you? They can see your stuff online.
No, you're not allowed.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. No. Look me up on the internet. I'm there. I do all kinds of stuff. And I'm working on an album at the moment of music. None of it about voting systems. So you'll love it. It's really entertaining.
What would your noise be for First Past the Post? And what would your noise be for the additional member system?
I think First Past the Post would be... An additional member might be... You know?
That's pretty good. That's very good.
Beardy Man, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, guys.
It's been great.
Bye.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, I think you've got a serious future ahead of you as a beatboxer. Should you ever want... I mean, I know public service is at your core. Is there no way you could combine it with your current job?
No.
A bit of beatboxing on the benches?
Beatboxing on the side.
I don't think so.
I think that'll be hard. Shall I thank our guests?
Yes.
Why don't I thank our guests? I'd like to thank Catherine Howarth, Adam Matthews and Yossi Caden.
And I will definitely think about the ethics of my pension should I ever get one.
Good.
And thanks to Beardy Man for giving us the gift of beatboxing.
Boots and cats.
Emma Caution produces our podcast with research by Joel Pierce. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. James Deacon made the idents. Ed Seath composed the music, and the artwork was designed by
Emily
Power. Well, he's been Bootsin.
He's been Catsin.
And these have been
Reasons to Be
Bootsin, Catsin, Bootsin, Catsin.
Bootsin, Catsin. Bootsin, Catsin. Bootsin.